Well, I've decided that we need more dignity today. And so I've named us the first annual Holden Village International Nordic Congress. I had thought of conference, but that's so downscale. Congress has a real meaning to it. And so I'm going to call us to order. And as you will note, at 2:15, my cell phone will ring. The international operator is putting through a call from Copenhagen. And I'll ask you not to rustle paper or chew gum and snap it. That would be discourteous and distracting. So we've got to move. I'm really sort of nervous. Anders Fogh Rasmussen, the Prime Minister of Denmark, is not the easiest person. He is not a candidate. He is not sought after for hiking and canoeing trips. If I may say so.
He's calling you
again? Yeah. But I want to move on now from that page one, which I hope you will find a lot. I've really tried to distill a great deal of information onto page one. And I'd like to now, before we get into our case studies of some public policy issues, I think it's important that you see the political party structure. Now, this overhead, please sit by somebody who has a handout, and because I've run out of handouts, and share.
Yeah, thank you.
Can you see?
Could you share?
Yeah.
This chart of seven political parties is not exact for any one of the five countries. It's my attempt to combine them. We simply and obviously don't have time to go through this, but I think in every one of the five nations, you're going to we have these seven parties, which have, of course, different names in different nations, have succeeded in being able to elect at least two persons to the parliament. Now, Denmark has a thriving Green Party, the Environmental Party, but I didn't include because, to my knowledge, Finland has not does not have any Greens in its parliament. But this is the standard issue. And what I want to show here is that this vertical line separates the houses of parliament on, let's see, I would like to be named the Speaker of the House, may I, for the meeting. Thank you for your graciousness. This side is the political left, that is on my left. And it includes, and I couldn't do this to scale, but in every one of the parties, this is the big war horse party. They used to go by the term Labour. So you know right away that their historic constituency was blue collar. And their historic vision has been that of achieving greater equality between the bosses, the poobahs, and the rank and file workers. And the Labour Party has controlled the parliaments and named the speakers off and on, of course, with interruptions. But if you start with 1905, when Norway achieved its independence, and look all through the 104 years ensuing, Labour has named the Prime Minister, forgive me for a guess, it's a wild stab, but for 80 of the 105 years. The Labour Party, and these were powerful parties. In the years before World War I and between World War I and II, these were leftist, you may want to say Marxist, this was a leftist Marxist party. These were the PMs, and there are great names among them, like Einar Gerhardsen from Norway, who suffered in a concentration camp through World War II. These were tough old birds, I tell you. And they went to the international congresses of labor parties, and they held their own with Bevan of the United Kingdom, or in later years, Willy Brandt of Germany. Now, the Social Democrats know that they can't quite do it alone. And so they are intent on wooing, sorry that it rubbed off, but I meant to say socialistic, I don't know what they, the socialistic left. That sounds pejorative, and I don't mean it that way, but it's a rather small party. It rather typically is able to elect 3 or 4 or 5 members to parliaments, which are typically about 150 in size. But Labour, I want to stop saying Labour, I want to say Social Democrats. It's smoother, I mean it's more marketable as a term. The SDs, if you're following me, will, when the new parliament convenes on a January in early January of the fourth year in these countries, the Social Democrats will say to the socialist left, "You can't do anything on your own. You're only 2 or 3 or 4 people. So play along with us, and we'll see that you are rewarded by having one of your 2 or 3 or 4 members of the parliament named to a ministry, so probably a rather innocuous one like schools." Okay, so here sits on the left the coalition that I'm calling SD, Social Democrats, who have historically controlled the Nordic countries. But now on the right of my vertical line, I have put they are called the bourgeois coalition. We don't use the term bourgeois in American political theory, but it's very much used in Europe. It means parties or individuals who own property, who have assets. It carries the connotation of middle class, upper middle class. And there are 4 parties which would include themselves in the bourgeois coalition and are ready to play poker with one another. They are, or bridge, I guess is a better analogy. They're ready to bid. And the largest of them is seeking a new word. Historically, they have called themselves, I'll use the Norwegian word, Høyre, which means the right wing. But that is not a very good word. I mean, it just doesn't sound good in an egalitarian country. And so they're fishing for a new name. Sweden's party on the right found a brilliant solution. They call themselves Moderaterna, the moderates. Oh, that is so nice. And they're the big group, and they represent the business and corporate interests. Hardly every businessman or corporate tycoon, but they represent the point of view that though there should be humanitarian policies and life standards for all citizens, these nations will go down the tubes unless their corporations, their private sector, is profitable. And so they tend to just shudder at some of the decisions that come out of the Social Democratic Party. But typically, of the 150, we just don't have time, obviously, for detail, there might be 30 parliamentary members in the the right, the party of the right. And so they have to play bridge or poker or whatever you want to say and say to three other very interesting parties, play ball with us and we'll form a coalition, and if we can get the majority, I think Sweden has 151 in its parliament, so if they can get 76, we can organize the parliament and we will see that you're rewarded. Same message as SD beams to the socialist left. You can't do it on your own, kids. But they're dealing with some very prickly parties here. In every one of the countries, there is an agrarian party. And again, agrarian has come to be farmery sounding, and no one wants that. So they've tended to take the name the Center Party. It's smooth. It's like Teflon. But the agrarians are principal agenda is to see that the people who live outside the capital cities, and in Denmark, Copenhagen and environs are now over half the population of Denmark. That's for any of us in public policy. It gets worrisome when the central city is over half of the population. The agrarians defend the idea that you've got to look after the smaller places. And so when the bourgeois coalition has ruled, the agrarians have pushed for a bill like this, asking for this kind of concession. Teachers or nurses or social workers who are government employees and are willing to go out into the furthermost, outermost provinces and towns get a bump in salary, sort of like hardship pay. That would be a typical agrarian agenda item. Or I had a fellowship to be in Sweden through the winter of 1976, 75, 76. And the bourgeois coalition unseated the Social Democrats for the first time, I believe. And they immediately pushed for, the agrarians went along with the Moderaterna, and they pushed through a bill that decentralized the ministries of government. So the Foreign Service was in Hirtshals, and the Interior Department was in Haparanda, and on and on and on. And the top-level civil servants were jumping out the windows in Stockholm. You know, I mean, they liked Stockholm. They had a lovely home, and they had, you know, the ballet, and they had a spouse in another civil service, and they were just dispersed. You know, just like quicksilver over the center parties would love that. They're very suspicious of capital cities. I think many of us grew up in center party traditions and would understand this. Then there's another party, and these people are really wiggly. They use the word liberals, and that will confuse everybody in the room. Yeah. You think it means left wing. It doesn't mean left wing like the Social Democrats mean left wing. The liberals are your intellectually, it's your academics, it's your media people, your creative types. Their newspaper in each of the countries, each of the parties, by the way, has its own daily newspaper, more or less. You can be on a tram car in Helsinki and you see seven different papers being read by the people on the car. The Liberal Party is a profound newspaper, always, at least the op-ed section, long critiques of new books out, new film, etc., etc. The problem for the Liberal Party, they never seem to get more than 10 members into any of the parliaments, is the problem of academics, and I've been there. media people, artists, etc. They can't agree on a platform. They can talk an issue to death. Oh yes, and let me not forget that the clergy are very likely to be somewhat sympathetic to the Liberal Party.
Yeah.
Now, let's say, and I'm making up numbers here, but that a parliament will run about 30 to 40 people here, and we're going for 76, right? And I hope these numbers will add up. And they'll pick up 10 more here, and 10 more here. So where am I? 56. My numbers aren't going to add up, but never mind. Trust me. If the bourgeois coalition is to organize the parliament and name a prime minister, they've got to get the support of what Norway calls Kristelig Folkepartiet, the Christian People's Party. And that, I think there are no parties quite like the five Christian parties. Now, as you know, in Germany, in Italy, there is a Christian party, but it tends to be synonymous with conservative.
Yeah.
It's not synonymous with piety. Nor is the Christian People's, are the Christian People's parties in Norden synonymous with piety or conservatism. They are parties of people who are seriously seeking links between Christian theology and public policy. And their newspaper, I read the Norwegian one online sometimes, Vårt Land, Our Country, is very thoughtful on its op-ed pages about such things as the importance of serious education in the elementary and secondary schools and religion, and what the balance should be between comparative religion and Christian doctrine. That would be an important topic. Or the appropriateness of the naming of a bishop who is in a monogamous same-sex relationship would be seriously addressed. I dwell on this a little bit. We are at a Lutheran retreat center, and I want to drive home the point. This party is not synonymous with your born-again anti-stem cell research. They wouldn't touch that kind of subject or homosexual anti-homosexuality. It's pretty profound. Well, it is an incredible juggling act for the the business party to woo all of these, because they're slippery parties. And on occasion, especially the agrarians, who are very good at saying to each side, what are you going to do for us today? And have on occasion gone over to caucus with the Social Democrats. But in the main, as you can see on page 6 of the textbook, the BC, the Bourgeois Coalition, has 3 of the 5 prime ministers. Please let someone who doesn't have a textbook look on with that. All right. Then there is, and we got to get going because Anders Fogh Rasmussen is on the line. My little light is going on my phone. You want to leave a prime minister sitting there. But then there is a new party movement, very powerful in Denmark and achieving great power in Norway. I don't know if it has surfaced in the other countries yet. And I've called it down here number 7, the 1,800-pound gorilla in the living room. And I've drawn dots around it. And I put it in the middle because it's not clear where they quite fit. Neither the Social Democrats nor the bourgeois coalition are very comfortable with this surging new party. And who are they? They tend to be, you know, colossal generations here. Younger, I'll call them MBA types, who have two great concerns. That taxes have gone so high that you can't have the good life in Norton, combined with a concern that the immigrant populations, though needed, somebody's got to swab the urinals in the railroad station, etc., but they're concerned that immigration has gone too far. In other words, you may say they're a concern, they sound as though they should be on the right, that it's a piece of cake for a business party to reach over to them and say, we're with you. But they're not. They would be odd bedfellows for this reason. The four established parties in the bourgeois coalition, they like their benefits. They believe in having a strong safety net that assures that children, the elderly, blah, 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 are taken care of. This new group, we can't figure them out. Just, they're, I would characterize them as a party that says this, ready, fire, aim. rather uncertain themselves of where they're going. But Denmark hadn't heard of this party 6 years ago. 4 years ago, they surged in and they got a majority of the parliament in one swell swoop. And they named a young politician, attorney, diplomat named Anders Fogh Rasmussen as their prime minister. So he represents, they use the word in Denmark, Fremtids party, the future, the party of the future. Nice ring, nice Teflon there. Now, with that, here's Anders. Got him on page six. Mr. Prime Minister, we are deeply honored that you would call us today. What's that you say? He's in a testy mood, so let me paraphrase what he said. He said, I've asked each of the prime ministers to speak about a paramount public policy issue in his or her country, except Prime Minister Sigridurdóttir can't participate in the conference call because the banks are in trouble again in Reykjavik. This is confidential. Must not go beyond this road. Now to Fogh Rasmussen, what he said to me was, nobody in Norden likes me. I'm the outcast among the prime ministers, and they are thick as thieves in the frequency of communication. You know, the hotlines, the red telephones, the getting together and alternating between capital cities, that kind of thing. He says, I'm a pariah, a leper. In that group, because I represent the new wave that is saying we've gone too far, we have to pull back again on taxes and immigration. And then he went on, poor guy, I really feel compassion for him and his government. He went on to say that Denmark, his country, more than even Sweden and Norway, which have plenty of the new immigrants, is facing the greatest crush of immigrants, and they are proving problematic. And if he even suggests that, he's vilified by his social democratic opposition and even his bourgeois coalition opposition as being anti-humanitarian. But he threw out this case study to us. And you may remember, and I don't have the date in my mind, but about 3 years ago, the political cartoonist for a Danish newspaper, Jyllandsposten, did a cartoon which depicted
Mohammed
in a derogatory way, and the Muslim population went bananas. Do you remember? They attacked the Danish embassies in cities all over the world, not least in Karachi and Cairo and Ankara. The Danish Foreign Service pulled back its diplomatic people to Denmark for safety reasons, and it there is no greater taboo, I suppose, than depicting Mohammed, an image of Mohammed. You don't draw him. Well, the Danish population went crazy on its own. Denmark, like the other countries, but maybe particularly Denmark, is extremely proud of its tradition of freedom of the press and freedom of speech. And the and Fogh Rasmussen's predecessor as prime minister said, we learn more from speech and thoughts which offend us than from those with which we are comfortable. But it has not placated the Muslim population, which is growing by leaps and bounds in Denmark. Understandably, Denmark shares a land border with Germany and so many Muslims who originate in Bosnia, Kosovo, Albania particularly, move up in search of a better life through Germany, which is not very hospitable, I must say, to immigrants, Muslim or otherwise, and to Denmark, where wages are very, very low. So Fogh Rasmussen finds himself and his government entangled in policy issues. The Muslims aroused now. It was like they were, somebody hit a hornet's nest with a baseball bat. They are really buzzing. And so they begin more and more to say that their girls, their daughters, should wear, I can't think of the word, a ski mask. What's that called? No, not the the ski mask. So you see, so their eyes.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Well, an immediate. Is there? I know there's a word.
Chatter. Did you just say it?
No.
No.
But the full mask.
The full mask with the eyes showing, like slits.
It's a ski mask.
My point. The teacher union immediately sent a communication to the government saying, you cannot teach children when you cannot know their facial reactions. You don't know if they're getting it, that sort of thing, which only escalated the controversy. Now, that's one small example. Another, in Denmark, they're feeling more opposition when in industrial workplaces, if there are clothing, safety rules on clothing. It just is terribly tangled. It's like Holland, it's like Germany, it's like France, and the immigrant population is getting angrier. We got a lot to cover. This is what Fogh Rasmussen just said to us. He said, I want to keep contact with our Nordic siblings. But he said, they have set so high a standard for the treatment of immigrants that I don't know if our treasury and I don't know if there's the public will to go as far as Sweden and Norway have gone in immigrant treatment. And now I have to segue a little bit. From the get-go, after World War II, when immigrants first began coming to Sweden, Norway, and Denmark, incidentally, Finland and Iceland just haven't received many immigrants. They're not streaming into those two countries. So I'll stick to the three on the Scandinavian peninsula. From the get-go, the departments that deal with family and children's issues, the ministries, determined that in Norden, immigrants would not be that dirty word, what Germany calls the Gastarbeiter, the guest workers, who sure as heck are not guests, but sure as heck they are workers. They work like slaves in those countries, but the minute there's no work for them, they're sent back to Turkey or wherever. The commitment of the Nordic countries was that they would make Swedes, Norwegians, or Danes of the immigrants by extremely expensive programs of teaching the language as a second, third, or fourth language. To wit, in Sweden, and I spent a winter living with Turkish workers. That was the winter I determined that I would campaign against cigarettes until I died. You try sharing a bedroom with three guys that set their alarm clock to light up. the point I want to make is that on the assembly line at Saab in Sweden or Husqvarna sewing machines, etc., you'll hear a little bell. And the workers, it will be told, all Turkish-speaking workers, please go to Salon 3A, where there's a tea tray with nice pastries and that kind of thing. And they, at government expense, government subsidizing the Saab Motor Works, receive an hour on the job with pay of Swedish as a additional language. You'd hardly say as a second language because Europeans, including lower educated workers, speak more than one language already. Well, I could go on with this, but you see the examples. And Fogh Rasmussen said, the immigrant thing has become my bête noire. And the phone is ringing. I mean, it's an honor to have a prime minister call us, but after all, that's their job. But the president of Finland is on the line, President Haavisto. And she said she's very eager to explain to us at our international congress a besetting issues in Finland. And her portfolio deals more with the foreign relations side. And Prime Minister Matti Vanhanen is more concerned with the domestic side. And so Hananen said just now, you heard it, but because you, many of you don't speak good Finnish, I'll paraphrase her. She said it's very important for Finland to keep its ties with Norden. We grit our teeth because of the insatiable demands of that 12% of our Finnish population, which calls itself Swedo-Finns, for whom Swedish is the primary language. And they insist that every sign in Finland be both in Finnish and in Swedish. And they insist that every municipality in Finland have two names. Helsinki, that's Finnish, and Helsingfors is the Swedish word. And the Swedo-Finns I mean, if one poster goes up in Finland that isn't in Swedish as well as Finnish, they raise holy hell. I don't know where I was, but Hallinen said, we grit our teeth, but we know the importance of having a link to Sweden. That's why we require that children beginning in third grade, I think, begin learning Swedish. But she said, in truth, we do not see our future in Norden as much as we do in the Baltics. Finns are extremely interested in cultivating strong relationship with the three former SSRs. Estonia, which is only 5 hours on the ferry boats, which leave Helsinki Harbor every hour on the hour to go to Tallinn, Latvia, and to a lesser degree, but a degree, Lithuania. And so Finland is mounting is making major appropriations for what we might, we'll call it government aid, foreign aid to those countries. And it's in her purview to try to figure out how Finland reaches to Norden, but reminds Norden that its primary community of interest is with the Baltic states, the Baltic nations, the former SSRs. And now Hallinen has passed the telephone over to Matti Vanhanen, who's in the upper right on page six, who says, you hear him, I want to tell you about an important conversation in public policy that I just had with our Minister of Church and Ecclesiastical Affairs, Education and Ecclesiastical Affairs. He said, we are extremely active. We're often called the most active member of the European Union. We have plunged into it full force, and we subscribe to the testing standards for children that were established in the so-called Treaty of Bologna. At the University of Bologna in Italy, there was a great conference about 10 years ago on the unification of the educational, of the curriculum of the EU. And Vanhanen, you got it, was saying, the good news is that for the third year in a row, Finnish children are top in Europe. Both on the mathematical scientific side and on the literary side in mastery. This is really remarkable, considering that, the year that the Soviet Union collapsed and Russia emerged, 1991, early 90s, when the Soviet Union collapsed, Finland nearly collapsed. The Soviet Union had been its major trading partner, buying all luxury goods, especially from Finland. And Finland was down the tubes. And in parentheses now, there was an overshoe factory, a rubber factory, in Finland, with the name that so many people think is Japanese, but it's Finnish, Nokia. And the Finnish public policy planner said, there ain't no future for us in overshoes. And they converted Nokia from a small company into, I believe it is Europe's fourth largest company on the publicly traded firm in Europe. It is huge. There is not a major market town in Finland which does not have a campus for Nokia. It has eclipsed Motorola and Ericsson, the Swedish cell phone makers. And Vanhanen wanted me just to say this to you. You think I don't have worries. My worry is that the golden egg that we've hatched called Nokia can only go sour downhill as people as everybody has a cell phone or a comparable device, and has every bell and whistle, sales are going to go down. Very worried in Finland about, you know, when you create, when you lead in one of the world's great technological advances, how long can you keep the lead? You know, you're new bells and whistles, but maybe the market can't figure out what they're how to use them. Well, and back now to Matti Vanhanen. He just wanted to strut a little bit about this number one pupils, both elementary and secondary. But he said something else that I think he'll find very interesting. He said, early on, after we became a nation, our educational planners in public policy said this: look, let's face reality. There isn't one person in the whole wide world who understands Finnish outside of Finland, nor will there ever be. It's one of those languages that the State Department, in its grading of the complexity of foreign languages, tells recruits to the Foreign Service, if you spend 20 years with a private tutor who works with you 17 hours a day, you will be able to ask where the toilet is. So he said, the public planner said early on, music must be the language with which we communicate to the outer world. And so in the major market towns, I should imagine there are 30 boarding secondary music schools in Finland. When a teacher in the elementary schools in Finland identifies a child who is gifted musically, the family is encouraged to think about a music academy. And so maybe at the age of 10, they go away and live for the week and come home on weekends. But what Vanhanen wants us to know is that it is paying off royally. Some of us here are from Minnesota, where the Minnesota Orchestra's director is Osmo Venska, who had been the director of the Philharmonic in Lahti, Finland's number four city in population. I believe that Venska is one of 14 Finns now who direct major world orchestras. Much more of an example, the Los Angeles Philharmonic is Esa-Pekka Salonen. And then Vanhanen, before he hung up, wanted to say one other thing. Our music academies are paying off in another regard. He said, using and taking opera and using singing an aria at La Scala in Milan as the gold standard. No country has had more operatic stars sing, perform at La Scala, other than Italy, than Finland. This is really quite remarkable. It also raises some serious educational questions. Should the most talented students be stripped out of their own schools where they're badly needed to play the violin? Think of a poor orchestra teacher in the town that loses her star, and on and on. But I think you see it. And we got to get going. That's why I wrote the background music is Sibelius. I lived for 3 months in Tampere in the dead of winter, and I lived in some godforsaken suburb, and I had to use a bus for part of the way. But I will never forget if I went home at about 4 o'clock when the schools, elementary schools were out, how many Finnish boys got on with a bag in each hand, a violin case and a gym bag. And I thought, oh my gosh, it don't get much better than that, does it? Yeah. So I'm going to answer a question that you haven't asked me, but I sometimes lie awake at night and think, if I could live in one of these countries, where would it be? Well, for a lot of reasons, though I've, my family and I have lived in Norway, I can't get enough of Finland. I'm just mesmerized by it. And I hope if you have the opportunity to travel, it's terribly expensive to get on as far east as Helsinki, but you have my email, and I'll be your second opinion travel agent. And the phone is ringing, and it's Jens Stoltenberg, whom I told you last time is the scion of one of Norway's most brilliant parties, mm-hmm. and who is Laborite. Mm-hmm. He is SD all the way. And so he just said, he said, I just don't know how we can continue to work with the Danes. They are so reactionary. He said, this new party, I'm scared to death of them. I'm scared to death of Anders Fogh Rasmussen. He said, will the liberal agenda, the SD agenda be lost in Norden if we have this sort of thing? And then he said, would you please tell the members of the Congress here about one of our public policy initiatives that we passed through the parliament a year ago, and though it's just giving our bourgeois coalition fits, it's taking place. The Norwegian parliament voted that any private corporation that sells publicly traded stock, board of directors must have not fewer than 40% of its members of any one gender. Do you get me? It's hard to say that clearly. What it really means is that at least 40% of the directors of every Norwegian corporation that is not privately held, I mean it's publicly traded, though private, must be female. Well, now Norway has led the pack in participation of women. The majority of the parliament are female. It has had a distinguished prime minister, Gro Harlem Brundtland, who is female. It's not a shabby record, but the Norwegians are saying that we will make no. We can't take baby steps on the equalization of the genders, and the battleground is our corporations and their policies, and that until we have women in sizable numbers asking questions of our traditional male oligarchies, things are not going to change. Well, that would be classic social democratic lingo. The equalization of conditions, whether it be for the working class vis-a-vis the bourgeois class or women and men. And so it has been a scurry in Norway, where Porsgrunn glass porcelain, for example, I make this up, but let's say it had a board of 24 people and 21 were men, and their constitution or whatever it's called, their bylaws say the board shall be no more than 24. They've had to let some men who have been accustomed to power to say sayonara and to go out and find women. Where there's been very little tradition of female participation in boards. Well, just think for a moment, if that edict came down as as legislative law from our Congress in the U.S. I have a good friend, a couple I visit frequently in Norway. She is the principal of a middle school in a town of 12,000 with a major furniture factory. and she is no slouch, but she would be the first to say she has never dealt with corporate financial matters, but she was wooed by that furniture factory, and now she is not only on the board, but she's been named to its executive committee, and they have just sent her, along with two others, to Sri Lanka to look at timber products and the feasibility of buying them, and she said, I just can't believe what is happening to me, to go from a little middle school to this kind of milieu. Well, we got to keep going. Stoltenberg is screaming. He said, you didn't stop to listen to what I really want to talk about in terms of public policy. Oil, and natural gas. I believe I said last time that I Googled up Monday, and the current value of the government's petroleum trust fund is, in American dollar, did I say $369 billion? I mean, this is more than the total assets, you might say, of 30, 40 nations put together. Who'd have thunk it that in a peasant country like Norway, fishermen, farmers, and foresters, that there would be such wealth? But Stoltenberg says, this is no cup of tea. For the oil will in time be depleted. It is a finite resource. And Stoltenberg said, but to our credit as Norwegians across the political spectrum, no one is saying that that fund, $300 billion, should be returned to the citizens. We hear that in Minnesota when we have a surplus. It's the taxpayers' money, and we'll give it back, and then we don't have a surplus, and then we have bad times, and then we wish we had that money, and blah, blah. But Stoltenberg said, so the management of the resource so that we don't extract too much oil too fast. We don't want to look like Scotland. We sure don't want to look like Nigeria. We sure don't want to mismanage the way the Russians are mismanaging their oil reserves, is a paramount issue for my government. Indeed, Stoltenberg would not be in power had it not been for the fact that his predecessor, the sentiment in the parliament was he was a little too loose in spending, letting the government spend money that should have been kept in the petroleum reserve. So Stoltenberg is walking on eggshells. At the same time, Norway holds an enormous, if not the ace, the king of spades in its hand, in that, and on pages 3 and 4, you have maps of Norway, of Scandinavia, in the textbook. At the top of Norway, where, and I'll bet not many of you knew this, where Norway borders Russia. Sweden does not have a common border with Russia, even though it's much nearer to Russia. Norway does at the top. And the body of water between the northern tip of Norway and, the North Pole is called the Barents Sea. And the geologists have determined that there is an unbelievable natural gas field, plural, and oil field or fields up there. But they have not yet, they do not have the technology yet to extract it profitably. It's extremely hazardous working conditions for the ships that would go up there, but it's there. And so Norway has, when the technology permits, it has an endowment that will make the $369 billion look like chicken feed.
But the
Russians.
Are they
fighting their claims on that then?
The Russians. Pardon.
Aren't they fighting their claims on who owns what part of the ocean?
Is it what?
Aren't they fighting their claims, Russia and Norway, on who owns
Yeah, I could have gone into that. Norway is well aware that the Russians have their eye on the Barents Sea also. It has never been a cup of tea to have a shared border with Russia. And that is Norway's lot. But meanwhile, fuming in the background because he thinks he's not going to get adequate time is our young whippersnapper Prime Minister Fredrik Reinfeldt of Sweden, who is, as Norden goes, represents a very conservative ruling party. The bourgeois coalition in Sweden is considerably more conservative than the bourgeois coalition in Norway or Finland. But Reinfeldt wants to talk about some things. Reinfeldt said, look, I'm not a church-going fellow, nor are 98-point-something% of my countrymen, but he said, I'm well aware that many people here are members of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, which has organic ties to the Evangelical Church of Sweden. And he said, I think I'd like to talk with you about Margaret Thatchering the church. Margaret Thatcher, you'll remember, was the apostle of divestment. She and Ronald Reagan were very similar philosophically. The bourgeois coalition in Sweden has passed legislation so that, in a sense, there is no longer a state church. In all five countries, the Evangelical Lutheran Church, with its strong German roots, has been the state church. The pastors are paid, and the organists and so forth, by the state. Their salaries are collectively bargained. They're unionized, as is every sector of the labor force in the Nordic countries. The heat and the light and the lights and repairing tuck pointing these magnificent old churches has been the responsibility of the state. And Reinfeldt said, we take the position in the bourgeois coalition that it being supported by the state, whether it be a ball bearings company or an automobile plant or a church body, is ultimately destructive to the spirit and the will and the mission, and thus with one swell foop the church has been divested. Was invited to a very interesting gathering not many months ago when a delegation of 12 young pastors from the Evangelical Church of Sweden came over to Minneapolis to meet with Bishop Greg Johnson and others. And what they were saying is, while we don't really know what's hit us, we need to know how to raise money because, Aunt Frederick, Uncle Frederick, isn't going to do it for us. And there is no tradition in the Nordic countries of collection plates, of pledging, of envelopes. There's no tradition of a united fund anything I can think of, because the Nordic people say, look, we pay upwards of 50% if we're well-educated professionals, maybe not 50, but in the 40s, in taxes, and we do that because we believe that Stockholm is a more efficient way of distributing the money than sentimental appeals to us. But it's all over, folks, for the state church. But it really isn't. It can't go quite that fast. And so a compromise before the bill was enacted was reached in which the members must pay through pledges, offering envelopes, bequests, whatever, to support the program. Pastor salary, the music for the choir, blah, blah. But the state, recognizing that the churches are the museums and the history and the repository of the culture of Sweden, will pay for upkeep, capital, the new roof, the repair of the cemetery where the a row of tombstones toppled, that sort of thing. So I think for those of us who are interested in the church, and it's very interesting that Sweden wants the American model of voluntary contribution, and I'll hazard the guess that that 50 years from now, I would imagine that a church free of the state will be a more spirited, enthusiastic church. But for the 49 years intervening, who's going to pay the pastor's salaries and for the music for the choir and on and on? I understand that presenters are executed at dawn if they go over, and it's right on 3 o'clock. But I'd like to say this. This frees anyone to leave, because you should have opportunity for questions. I haven't done my job if I haven't given you that. And then at the very end, I'd like a PS to try for a theoretical statement about Norden. So questions, and will you bell our artists?
David, we're going to talk about child care leave, paternity leave.
Yeah. May I? It's very important, and I just didn't know how to ration this. Two factoids here are very important. In all five of the Nordic countries, there is the strong commitment to the idea, well, to the importance of children. And so at childbirth, a mother, the bio mother, will receive 52 weeks of salary, of her full salary, at 80% of her full salary, or 100% for 40 weeks, or something like that. And with each additional child, until these children are 18, they're pulling in, and I just Googled it this morning, and I couldn't get an absolutely current figure, but 2 years ago, the Norwegian check for a child was in American dollar about $180. So if you had two children, the state pays you $360 a month until the first is 18, and then one, whatever I said, 60. It is very, very expensive. And there are two, and of course there will be inflationary adjustments to that amount. But what is also very important here is that the bio mother is not entitled to, quote, her what's called mama year at 80% full pay for a whole year, unless the bio father is home alone with the child for 4 weeks. In that year, when the bio mother can go off to Tahiti for all the government cares about it. And now that's interesting public policy, isn't it? And I teach this stuff regularly in the Osher Lifelong Learning Institute at the University of Minnesota. And almost invariably, I just simply have not been able in two sessions to give you time to formulate your questions very well. But somebody raises their hand and says, well, what if the bio father is an abusive brute? Well, from the standpoint of my men's consciousness raising group, I mean, thinking of us guys as brutes and women as cuddly and endearing and maternal and all that. We don't like that at all. But I would have to say, if either of the parents, if there is instability, and someone presents that issue to the ombudsperson for children, they'd make another arrangement. But the fantastic thing is that if you have children the age of my children, my grandchildren were in kinder care or some franchise like that, 4 weeks, something like that after they were born. My daughter could have had a year. I'm sure she would have wanted the full 52 weeks and taken only 80% pay, and my son-in-law could have had his 4. So, in answer. Yeah, Jackie?
Single mothers, too, with children, don't they?
Pardon me?
Single mothers, don't they get...
Yeah, if they're... Yes, as are... I don't want to say... It might be a majority of mothers are single mothers, but that's a misnomer. It doesn't mean that there isn't a relationship with a bio father.
Yeah.
It just means they're not married. There isn't a lot of percentage in marrying as we know in Europe. It's not perceived to be to have many advantages, and certainly not in Norden. Okay, yeah, Paul.
Louder, please.
You'll repeat it.
Louder.
David's going to repeat it. How have these countries reacted to the problems of climate change and global warming? Denmark has this great industry building wind turbines in southern Norway, and Iceland has this great geothermal resource.
Question about global warming and climate change. Paul, I need to do some Googling, and I'll if you'll email me, I have a reprint at home that I'll email to you. I just don't dare get in there because it's not my bag. I know it's very important, the programs in those countries to avert global warming. The Green Parties, though they may not all have members of Parliament, but they're very active. Youth groups, green groups. I'm sorry, Paul, I can't handle the question further. Well, a coda at the end. Because I don't want this just to be disparate facts, but how can we tie this together? And I'm going to try it this way. If you looked in the telephone directories in the yellow page section, you'd find this word in the F, folk, F-O-L-K, over and over and over. I don't know its Finnish equivalent, but as, for example, Pastor Rosenberg spoke at our Vespers last night about Nikolai Grundtvig, the founder of the folk high school movement, where people of our ages can go for a year, Holden Village kinds of concepts, which now dot the Nordic countries. Folk, or in every market town, there's a big building which includes the public library, the movie house, which is owned privately but is given space because it's a communal activity to go to the movies, recreation rooms for youth with the pool tables and that kind of thing, the swimming pool, etc. And it's called in Norwegian the folkahus, the folk house. Folk everything, the folk telephone company. And it translates rather obviously to the people. It's the community. That, I think, is the binding, is the chemical bond in Nordic public policy and cultures, the people. There is not a word, so to speak. I mean, it's not the individual. I think if we could do a content analysis in the United States of America, we would see many more references to the rights of the individual. Thus, to segue, it has been taken for granted since the automobile, since there were roads and automobiles, that if you are stopped by a police officer, even lacking evidence, you haven't been weaving or anything like that, but a random stop, and you turn out to have, I think it's more than five parts alcohol in your blood to the thousand. In Minnesota, we use eight, I think. Doesn't matter. You go to jail immediately. You're on your way to your wedding. Well, tough bounce, sister. You go to jail for 21 days. And you pay a whopping fine, which in Finland is geared to your income. A Nokia executive was stopped, and he had too high a promille, and he paid a fine because of his income of about $30,000, and the license plates were taken off the car for a year. And that's, you see, because it's not the individual who's important. It's the person who might be hit by that individual and the children in the back seat. If we could go on and on with that. The Nordics just don't understand it, that we don't penalize heavily if you're on a motorcycle or a bicycle without a helmet, because if you are in an accident and you live but you're a vegetable for 55 years and are supported out of our Blue Cross premiums, we are. It's the community that suffers. Never mind you. You're not the principal player. And we could go on and on with people who are seen chattering into cell phones, or if they could be detected, texting. The assumption is you fine, you penalize if it is injurious to the folk, to the community. Well, it's been, I took this on very short notice, and to try to compress so much into two meetings has been a little bit of a conundrum for me, but I enjoyed it immensely. And if anyone wants to hang around, Carol Hinderly told me that the room is ours, or at supper tonight, or whatever. I'd love to talk more. Okay, thank you.